Oh, yes, it could, and yes, it is. And about a year ago today, exactly, the East Coast, especially the tri-state area, was waking up to a nightmare that even climate scientists perhaps had not expected to hit so quickly. It was the perfect storm, of course, known as Superstorm Sandy, and the sea level rose. The storm gathered steam over the Atlantic Ocean and tide and everything combined to make it one heck of a storm, and they are still recovering. If you saw any of the coverage in the last 24 hours of Superstorm Sandy, the impact a year later, you know that whole neighborhoods, homes, are still not only not rebuilt, but in some cases not even begun to be reconstructed. So the red tape, the, you know, problems of where do we rebuild, should we retreat, all that really was brought home by Sandy. So it was no longer just something off in the distant future in terms of climate change bringing horrific storms and sea level rise, but something that's already here. So we thought it'd be a good opportunity to check in with a climate scientist just recently brought to my attention. Dr. Radley Horton is joining us. He is an associate research scientist at the Center for Climate Systems Research at Columbia University's Earth Institute, also affiliated with the Goddard Space Program at NASA. So thank you for joining us. I know you've been a busy guy. I've seen you kind of all over the place on CBS and MSNBC, and I've been covering climate change and green issues for over 10 years on the radio, so we're glad you made time for us as well.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
You are someone who has been studying this. Let's just go back a year and take us through what you were thinking as you were watching the impact of Superstorm Sandy unfold. Was it, in fact, something you did not expect to see, you know, this early on, or were you not surprised at all, you and your colleagues?
I would say that we had a pretty good sense of what a storm of Sandy's size could do to many parts of the city in terms of the effects it would have on infrastructure, such as subways and all the really myriad infrastructure and community impacts we saw. But what was really striking was the size and strength of the storm. We knew it was a possibility, but I think especially the force of that storm surge and the amount of water that was pushed on shore was really remarkable. You know, in some ways, it's important to remember that, you know, Sandy could have been worse. We have hurricanes at times that bring more rainfall. It even brings stronger winds. But from this perspective of the storm surge, the piling up of water, the fact that the storm hit right at high tide, the track that it took, and the sheer size of it, meaning so much water piled up, those really combined to make it, from a storm surge perspective, about as bad as anything we could imagine.
Mm. And I imagine you probably were in Manhattan a year ago because you're with Columbia, and if so, you know, what was your experience as you woke up the next day a year ago?
Yeah.
October 30th.
So I live a little bit north of the city in the lower Hudson Valley, but one of the things that really struck me, well, one thing to mention is that the forecasts, you know, as the storm started to develop over the Atlantic, were pretty good in the sense that some of the European models, as early as a week before the storm, were suggesting this possibility that it would take a track such as it did. So we had some sense that this could happen, but when I woke up the morning as Sandy approached, that Monday morning, I was struck by how extreme the flooding was, you know, really 12 hours before the direct hit. We were already seeing so much water piling up in parts of the city. So that was really, I think, a warning for a lot of people that next tide, you know, 12 hours later in the evening, was going to be devastating. And, of course, we saw that devastating was probably an understatement, if anything. My personal experience, you know, in the lower Hudson Valley was, you know, essentially fortunate compared to so many New Yorkers and people in New Jersey. You know, it's important to remember that Sandy had big impacts across a broad area. We had heavy snowfalls as far away as West Virginia. We had, you know, storm surge issues all up and down the coast. And where I am, you know, a fair amount of tree damage, knocked out power for a while, but compared to what the people on the coast of New Jersey and New York City and Long Island experienced, the impacts were pretty trivial where I am.
And from where you sit and work, do you sense that, you know, more New Yorkers, people, you know, that you come across outside of your professional circles, are aware that something really is going on with our weather, and it could well be a climate crisis brewing?
I think that in general, in New York City, there is a pretty broad acceptance that climate change is happening, that we're on a track for it to get a lot worse in the future. I think that, you know, there are always going to be exceptions, but in general, a lot of people in New York City, a lot of agencies are sort of moving to the phase of thinking about solutions, whether in terms of greenhouse gas emissions reductions, how to adapt to some of these climate changes that are coming, how to minimize the effects, say, of higher sea levels or higher temperatures. Relative to other parts of the country, I would say New York is pretty far along in that conversation, although we certainly have a lot farther to go. But at least, you know, and I think part of this is due to the mayor's leadership. This science really has been embraced throughout throughout the Bloomberg administration. When they've looked at things like sea level rise, they've considered extreme scenarios. You know, the possibilities of sort of worst case scenarios of sea level rise. From a risk management perspective, you know, it's prudent to consider some of those possibilities if you're trying to protect critical infrastructure that's likely to last for 100 years or more, such as water tunnels, bridges, and such.
And Mayor Michael Bloomberg certainly has been, you know, a civic leader in terms of not only, you know, taking on adaptation efforts, but also, you know, with his comments in the wake of Superstorm Sandy and Chris Christie, you know, standing next to President Obama. Did that really, you think, rally support, not political support, but just, you know, just public thinking in terms of, you know, this is something that it should be transpartisan, it's practical, and it's something that's impacting our lives now, and perhaps not even then could they see how long into the future just the impacts of Sandy would be felt.
I think that's right, and I think some of those some of those meetings sort of helped really underscore that, you know, while individual cities at times might experience particular climate events, really to prepare for the hazards of the future is going to take action at a variety of scales. It's certainly a role for everything, you know, as minor as individual action, you know, looking in on our neighbors during any type of sort of extreme event, storing water and food, those sort of small-scale actions. But if you go right up to scale, you know, clearly we also need national leadership. There are going to be some strategies, some discussions that really will be most effective at a national or even international scale. So we do need action across that whole range of continuum, as you said.
And unfortunately, my co-host, D.R. Tucker, could not join us today, but he is the one who connected us, so I really appreciate that. And he and I talk often on this program, as regular listeners know, about, you know, why isn't the mainstream media doing more dedicated programming, you know, the large commercial radio television networks. Because Sandy did hit the media capital as well as the financial capital of our country, are you seeing more, you know, coverage, not just a mention of climate change, you know, in conjunction with, you know, wildfires or drought or, you know, record flooding? Certainly it started to be mentioned more in the wake of Sandy, but as someone who has personally lobbied, you know, programmers and syndicators at some of the major networks to do more programming on the solutions and what are we going to do about not just climate change, but what's going on with our, you know, oil and oceans and diversity and species and, you know, fuel needs, and they look, well, I don't know how they look at you because it's usually done over the phone, but I get responses like, well, we wouldn't do anything on the environment. That's advocacy. We couldn't do that. And yet, you know, it's been politicized and, you know, made to look like an advocacy issue when, in fact, it's about our survival. So I don't know if you would have any, you know, anecdotal stories to share with us about what your sense of media gatekeepers might be in the wake a year later of Superstorm Sandy, or what you've observed in media that perhaps wasn't there before Sandy hit.
Yeah, so I think you know, you might have a fuller perspective on that than I do, but I will say, and maybe the way I would characterize it is that there's been sort of a downward trend over several years, maybe in coverage of climate issues and other sustainability issues, but that post-Sandy there has been an uptick. You know, I don't know if it's sort of gotten us back to levels of coverage of several years ago, which themselves were probably way too low, no doubt, relative to the risks involved.
It was.
right, wouldn't you say? Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So, but no, I do think there's been, you know, some improvements in the last year. I think, you know, getting discussions out there about current vulnerabilities, the idea that no matter what you think about climate change or sort of how severe it might be in the future, we have these vulnerabilities today, and there are steps we can take to, you know, to reduce those vulnerabilities that make sense no matter what happens with climate change. But of course,
so
climate change.
Go ahead.
But of course, climate change really.
What should we be doing, and what should we be thinking about? And I'm sorry to interrupt you twice. Mm-hmm. Go ahead and finish that thought, and maybe that's where you're going. Is what would be your advice for where we go from here, given what you know in your studies about sea level rise and all these other factors?
Yeah, so I think, you know, clearly, you know, one of the most important points to emphasize is that we're going to see acceleration of some of these climate changes we've observed in the past. Sea levels in the New York region have gone up by about a foot over the last century. Globally, they've gone up about 7 or 8 inches or so. It doesn't sound like much, but that small change alone already is increasing the frequency of coastal flooding events. As we get out into the future, we're going to see even more sea level rise, precisely because we're moving further away from these equilibrium levels of carbon dioxide that we used to have back before the Industrial Revolution. As we burn more and more fossil fuels, as we change the land surface more, carbon dioxide levels are going up, more heat-trapping gases mean more warming of the atmosphere, more warming of the upper ocean, and more sea level rise. And the bottom line point to emphasize is that small shift in the averages, 2 feet of sea level rise, a few degrees of average temperature increase, profoundly changes the frequency of these extreme events that affect society, you know, so profoundly. So our research suggests that if we get, say, 2.5 feet of sea level rise towards the end of the century, which is a very sort of middle-of-the-road projection, but even that level of sea level rise, and even if storms themselves don't get any stronger, just that higher baseline, that higher floor, could give us something like 5 times as frequent coastal flood events in the future, even if storms don't get any stronger. Mm. That's the same story with other deadly events such as heat waves. I think people underestimate the risk of heat waves, especially long-duration heat waves. As you raise those average temperatures, you're going to get more days over 90 degrees. When they happen, they're going to last for longer periods of time. The nights are going to be warmer, so people's bodies and the energy system aren't going to be able to recover. And, of course, those absolute high temperatures are going to be even higher. You know, 2 degrees of warming doesn't sound like much, but if it's the difference between 100 degrees and 102 degrees, you're talking about, you know, you're talking about lives lost potentially, and you're talking about a much bigger drain on the energy grid in the way of trying to provide air conditioning and resulting greater risk of power failures precisely when the public needs to have access to air conditioning.
And just 2 weeks ago, I flew into New York for 5 days and noticed that it was in the low 70s most every day I was there. And while, of course, it was pleasant walking around Manhattan and everybody was enjoying the, you know, calm weather before winter set in, it's disturbing when you think about what this is doing to ecosystems, because Mother Nature, you know, is confused. And I just wondered what you think when you're walking around in 70-degree weather, you know, in late October. You're certainly, you know, used to the East Coast weather more than I am, but I think that was pretty unusual.
Yeah. So it's, you know, as a climate scientist, we have to point out that for any one place, you know, you can get a lot of year-to-year variability. But when we start to average across broader regions, when we look at the entire U.S., and instead of looking at, you know, a few days, when we look at sort of multi-year periods, you're onto something in that, you know, nationally, we've seen far more frequent extreme heat events than we've seen extreme cold events. If you look at the decade from 2000 to 2010, in the U.S., we broke about twice as many records for extreme heat as we broke for extreme cold. So the dice are being loaded in a sense. You're shifting the averages, and even if the averages, you know, are seem like a small change, 1 or 2 degrees of warming, it's already having a big impact on extremes in the sense that we're rolling a lot more sixes in the way of high temperatures and a lot fewer ones in the way of low temperatures.
And let's go back to the issue of communicating the science. You're very articulate, and you speak plain English. And how important is that in getting more, you know, experts in your field as you are out there to the public? And are you, in fact, seeing more demand, you know, for interviews on the part of your colleagues, not just at Columbia, but maybe just across the board? You know, we've had Dr. Michael Mann on this program quite a few times, Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, Dr. Jim Hansen years ago. It's so important, I think, not only to have climate scientists who can speak plain English, but also to have, you know, media as kind of a middleman. You know, I think it'd be great if climate scientists went out and spoke directly to the public, but you can only reach so many people in a lecture. That's where mass media really, I think, is still not doing its job in getting these important ideas and trends and, you know, very complex and urgent challenges out there, as well as what the heck do we do about it?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I do think that I completely agree with you. You know, we need a major sort of leadership by the media here. I think another thing that we can do as climate scientists is, you know, devote at least a good portion of our research to applied questions that directly influence human populations. So things like studying how, not just how many more heat waves are we going to get in the future, but linking with epidemiologists, health officials, to try to assess how many more people might suffer as a result of those heat waves, what might happen to agricultural production in the future. I think when climate scientists engage with other groups of scientists, other knowledge providers, that can be a way to help elevate some of these messages and get the word out that this is not just an esoteric subject, but current climate hazards and climate change are going to have a big impact on people and ecosystems.
And in the last couple of minutes we have, I can't resist asking you, how angry do you feel when you hear about the Koch brothers, for instance, or the fossil fuel industry, you know, fueling the disinformation campaigns that are really, you know, holding back progress and certainly wasting precious time?
Yeah, I think what's frustrating is the way a small group can impact and influence the thinking of a lot of well-meaning people. So I think there are a lot of people out there who don't sort of approach this subject ready to attack the science, but maybe have some sort of pre-existing beliefs, for example, about, you know, what level of regulation we should have in the country. Maybe a tendency, for example, to focus on what they can see with their own eyes. Of course, as we sort of mentioned earlier, in terms of looking at one place, on the climate change issue, what you see directly with your own eyes isn't always the best source of information. So I guess what I'm getting at is I think the majority of the people who question climate science actually come from a well-meaning place. But as you said, there is a group that is planting disinformation, or in some cases just unwarranted doubt, and it ends up affecting a lot of people who don't sort of approach it trying to attack or question the science, but maybe when provided with some of that ammo or false ammo, then unfortunately end up being misled.
Yeah, I find it frustrating when people fail to distinguish, you know, between something being, having been politicized and something being political. You know, when I've been in some, you know, let's say less progressive circles, social settings, whatever, and I can't help myself bring up climate change or some environmental topic, you know, inevitably I'll get some comment like, well, it's political,
right,
as if, you know, it's merely in the political realm, and therefore
right,
we don't have to really discuss it, worry about it, argue about it. It's political. It's been politicized. It's been co-opted when it should
right,
be, you know, the most practical of all
yeah,
matters that we deal with, and I think that is the continuing frustration on so many people's part. That, and I can only imagine as a climate scientist dedicating your career to getting these facts out, to see that it is continuing. I mean, turn on Fox News and you will see, you know, garbage being spoken when it comes to not believing the science. And it's, I think the fact that it's gone on so long and that some of these outlets have such huge audiences that really, you know, continues to be a problem.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's I think that weather issues and climate change really have a way of affecting really all aspects of society, but especially our most vulnerable groups. So it is so critical that the message get out there that, you know, we're all vulnerable today, no matter what you think is going to happen in the way of climate change. But then in the next sentence, we have to acknowledge that all the best evidence suggests that climate change is going to increase a lot of our vulnerabilities, even while there are going to be, you know, the occasional example of things that may be improved along the lines of, you know, fewer cold air outbreaks might mean less need for energy for heating in the future. Unfortunately, those sort of positive examples tend to be associated with a lot more negatives in the way of more frequent extreme events. And even for something like fewer, you know, cold events in winter in the future, which, you know, certainly for some groups is an advantage, if we look at something like an ecosystem perspective, it's not at all clear that warmer winters or less cold air outbreaks would be a good thing.
Thank you, Dr. Radley Horton, for your comments. I hope we can include you as one of our go-to climate resources. Really appreciate your joining us and all your work at Columbia.
Thank you very much.
And the Goddard Institute. That does it for this edition of the show. If you miss part of it, please go to the archives at prn.fm or thegreenfront.com. See you next week. In the meantime, have a great green one.